Welcome to KDNK's weekly newsreel, a news magazine that takes a look at the week's top local and regional news stories aired on KDNK between Monday and Friday. Subscribe to our podcast and give us a review on iTunes. If you have a tip on something you'd like the KDNK news team to cover, send it to news@kdnk.org. All submissions are confidential. The weekly newsreel is underwritten by RJ Paddywax Pet Outfitters next to City Market in Elgebel, open 7 days a week. More info at 970-963-1700 or rjpaddywax.com. I'm Amy Haddon Marsh, your host. First, let's take a look back at some of this week's headlines.
Pending approval from Glenwood Springs City Council, teachers could take their classes to Hanging Lake for a reduced rate of $3 per student, reports the Post-Independent. The standard rate is $10. Glenwood Mayor Jonathan Godis says the city should take the opportunity to reduce barriers for students to experience the outdoors.
Two decisions were made this week in the ongoing saga of the Jordan Cove project. On Wednesday, according to a press release from Rogue Climate, an Oregon-based environmental group, the Oregon Department of Land Conservation and Development denied a federal consistency review for the project. The state determined that the project would cause significant adverse coastal effects, among other things. This set the scene for the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC's, decision Thursday to delay approval for the project. OregonBizJournals.com reports that FERC voted 2-1 against certifying the $10 billion pipeline and LNG export terminal in southern Oregon. Commissioner Bernard McNamee stated that FERC needed more time to review permit denials from the state. Another commissioner said the project was not in the public interest.
The 27th Street Bridge and new roundabout officially opened in Glenwood Springs last week, and already there is concern that the roundabout may be too small. The Post-Independent reports that the diameter is 98 feet, which is too small for full-size semi-trucks. Glenwood Springs Fire Chief Gary Tillotson says all city fire trucks can navigate the roundabout, as can smaller food delivery trucks. The Glenwood Springs City Council and city engineers want to give it 6 months before considering any changes.
At the State House this week, lawmakers advanced a bill that would allow dogs at restaurants and rejected 6 bills that were criticized by the LGBTQ community. And Democrats unveiled legislation this week to create a statewide paid family leave program that would give workers time to care for a sick relative or newborn.
In many ways, the debate is the same for Senator Faith Winter, finding a way to give moms more than 2 weeks to be at home with their newborns. But getting there may mean giving up parts of her dream.
The biggest change is last year it was a social insurance program where every employee and every employer paid into a state-run program. This changes it because it's run to ensure a private market that's affordable.
In other words, the latest version won't be as ambitious or impactful. As written now, only companies with more than 20 employees will have to provide a leave program, and the length of time has been cut from 12 weeks to 8 weeks.
I don't think out of the gate this is going to be something or can be something that is going to be universal. It's just too much to take on all at once.
And Governor Jared Polis is the biggest reason why. He made it clear at the start of the session that he doesn't support having the state run the program itself.
We want to make sure that the state's not on the hook from a fiduciary perspective, that taxpayers aren't at any risk from it.
So Winter worked with the governor on a new draft of the bill.
He has been very involved and is extremely on board with this plan.
And she's making other changes to gain support. For example, the bill would not apply to seasonal workers like those at ski resorts, but Winter hopes it will eventually be expanded to include them.
Ultimately, in 2027, it goes to 12 weeks of paid leave with a rulemaking that will work to set goals towards universal coverage, both for small businesses, seasonal workers, and we will get to where everyone in Colorado has paid leave.
We all want people to be able to care for the people that they love, for their family members.
But there are still skeptics.
The reality is you peel this onion down all the way to its core, and at its core is an enormous tax.
Republican Senator Paul Lundeen says he'll fight against it when it reaches his committee. He fears a new state program would hurt small businesses.
We don't want the government getting in the way, shutting down a wonderful program to roll out something that may not even be sustainable over time because the tax consequences, the economic consequences, can be so negative that the whole thing falls like a house of cards at some point down the road.
My friends on the Republican side of the aisle would rather deal in tax credits, but if we're dealing in tax credits, low-income workers would never have access, in my opinion, to something like this.
Winter knows she faces opposition, but believes the bill will save lives.
I've met cancer patients that skip their second round of chemotherapy because they can't afford to lose their job, because their choice is to either battle cancer or not be able to pay rent. And when you're battling for something that saves lives, you can't stop working for it.
So with so much at stake, is there a plan Senator Lundeen and other critics will accept? He says there's always a way forward.
You need to have something that's sustainable, and you need to do something that pulls people into a system, because if people choose to opt into something, it will have a greater likelihood of surviving, being sustainable, and continuing on. Using government fiat to force something that may or may not be economically sustainable usually ends in tears.
While Winter would have preferred a universal model like the one that failed last year, she thinks the compromises she's made will get enough support to get it passed even without Lundeen's vote. More than a dozen states have debated bills like Colorado's in recent years, but only eight, including California and New York, have passed their own paid family leave programs. I'm Scott Franz at the State Capitol.
And in Utah, legislators will consider a new state park honoring dinosaurs in the Moab area. A bill could appropriate $10 million for the creation of Utah Raptor State Park north of Arches National Park. KZMU's Molly Marcello has more.
Utah Raptor State Park would include the famous Dalton Wells Dinosaur Quarry, located on the southern end of what's known as the Dinosaur Diamond Scenic Byway, a 500-mile-long loop passing through various paleontological sites in Utah and Colorado. Dr. James Kirkland is the state paleontologist for Utah.
And I think they actually have more dinosaur species at Dalton Wells than occur at Dinosaur National Monument. It's pretty exciting. They're all locals. You have Moabosaurus and Utah Raptor, Gastonia. All these things are only in the Moab area.
Moab's elected officials have raised concerns in recent years about protecting these natural resources at Dalton Wells. As local visitation numbers grow, more people are drawn to unregulated, dispersed camping in the area. Reports of trash and litter, as well as human waste, are on the rise. The $10 million appropriation would fund more comprehensive management of the area. In his experience, Kirkland says efforts toward resource protection and interpretive services also help reduce vandalism at paleo sites.
You know, it's much less likely that someone's going to go in there and try to steal something, where any moment someone could be coming to see the site and realizing, you know, maybe they're not supposed to be hacking these dinosaur tracks out of the ground.
If the Utah Raptor State Park bill passes during the legislative session, it would create the state's 45th park. Reporting from Moab, Utah, I'm Molly Marcello.
You're listening to KDNK's weekly newsreel, highlighting regional and local stories aired on KDNK between Monday, February 17th and Friday, February 20th. With in-kind support from Rifle Community TV, providing local information and non-commercial programming, including coverage of Rifle City Council, RE2 School Board, the Energy Advisory Board, Northwest Colorado Oil and Gas Forum, and more. Rifle TV is at riflenow.org. I'm Amy Haddon Marsh, your host. Back in the Roaring Fork Valley this week, artists create climate-inspired art with special climate-saving supplies for the Community Office of Resource Efficiency, and a makerspace goes up in Garfield County. First, here's more from KDNK's Kathleen Shannon on four new public art billboards that go up next week as part of CORE's month-long Imagine Climate initiative.
CORE has invited four different Valley artists to make 8-foot by 8-foot billboards for public display starting next week, and the pieces will have some things in common. They'll all be black and white, bilingual, and contain the same slogan, "This art is made from carbon emissions." Each piece was created using a recently developed substance called air ink, which is made from air pollution. The inventor of the ink, Anirudh Sharma, said this in his 2019 TED Talk.
There are factories around the world that are burning fossil fuels to produce carbon black to make black inks that we use on an everyday basis. But given that millions of liters of fossil fuels are already being burned out there by our cars, our engines, and our exhausts out there, what if you could capture that pollution and use it to recycle and make those inks?
Sharma's question led to the development of Air Ink and the founding of GraviKey Labs, which continues to produce the ink. The lab makes 1 fluid ounce of ink from about 45 minutes of diesel engine pollution, which in turn makes 1 marker. Chris Erickson, one of the Carbondale billboard artists, said he used less than 2 markers to create his billboard. Though he was skeptical of the ink's quality when he agreed to the project, it proved, pen in hand, to be fantastic. There is a pointed commentary behind creating billboards, often seen from highways, with vehicle emissions. That commentary is not lost on these artists. Erickson, who has already been working in black and white in his recent collection, looks to create art with a flat, dense, and saturated finish.
You know, everything's black and white. I don't use any grayscale. And that is kind of a statement on the binary culture that we live in. Everything is very black and white and right and wrong. So I really wanted to play with that.
As for the content of his piece, Erickson says,
the piece I did for this is a statement on industrialization. So it kind of just dovetails perfectly with the whole pursuit of the Air Ink.
Brian Colley, the other Carbondale-based billboard artist, took a very different approach to implementing the Air Ink. While he works primarily in painting and printmaking, he called on his background in watercolors for this project. He found the ink to be a very versatile substance that could be diluted and used with brushes and cloths.
Just because I've never painted with carbon emissions, like, who gets to do that? And so it's just been very cool to imagine some kind of landscape, and I've created like a giant monster made out of cars. Carzilla, if you will.
For Erickson, the billboard project serendipitously aligns with a personal project, building a new home. In fact, he had already been working with CORE on creating a more sustainable heating plan for his home when they approached him about the climate billboard project. There is significant overlap there, as the art supply and construction industries share similar challenges in sourcing sustainably made materials and in disposing of their waste products responsibly. In this case, CORE's initiative connects dots between the two. The billboard project is part of CORE's second annual Imagine Climate, a month-long exploration of climate-based art born of the nonprofit's 25th anniversary in 2019. Lara Whitley, CORE's brand and creative strategy director, says that they aim to create shifts in the systems and culture that are in place around climate change, and that this initiative targets the cultural piece. Whitley describes the Climate Billboard project as deeply collaborative, with more than 4 dozen speakers, artists, sponsors, and other partners involved. She says it is truly a project by the community for the community. The Climate Billboard Project will be opening at 2 free public kickoff parties next week, Tuesday from 6 to 7:30 p.m. at the Launchpad in Carbondale and Wednesday at the Collective in Snowmass. Air Ink inventor Anirudh Sharma will be giving speeches, the artists will be present to talk about their works, and there will be live carbon labs, music, and refreshments. Starting Tuesday, Erickson's billboard will be on display at Lions Park in Basalt, and Colley's will be at the Launchpad in Carbondale. You can also find Kelly Peters' work at the Collective in Snowmass and Kate Howe's in the Aspen Art Museum. For KDNK, this is Kathleen Shannon.
CORE hosts kickoff parties with billboard artists next week in Carbondale and Snowmass. You can see all 4 billboards on display together for the first time at the upcoming 5 Point Adventure Film Festival in April. More information is at aspencore.org. Colorado State University and Garfield County are partnering to create a new 12,000-square-foot education center in Rifle. KDNK's Lucas Turner has the story.
The two-story education center will feature spaces for the community and 4-H members to learn woodworking, metal fabrication, cooking, quilting, sewing, robotics, and more. It will also feature a shooting range. Andy Korber is the owner of Carbondale-based Land and Shelter, the architectural and planning firm that's been designing the space. She describes it as a makerspace.
In this space, we'll have kitchen, sewing, robotics, a wood shop, a metal shop. There will be the ability to create things using digital means, your hands, you know, industrial equipment and things like a stove. So it's really varied, but I think of it as a place where you can just generate things with your body and mind.
The education center is being planned inside of an existing building at 937 Railroad Avenue in Rifle near the fairgrounds. Garfield County purchased the location for just under $2 million last summer. The county is also contributing funding for architectural planning and has budgeted $400,000 for the renovations. The rest of the funding will come from grants and contributions made to the CSU Foundation. Andy Dureau is an architect for land and planning and the job captain for the project. She spoke about the challenge of designing a space with so many different uses.
We had to try to manage all of these different programmatic asks, put them in a kind of logical position so that people can easily flow between them and make sure they all fit, which was, I think, really the biggest challenge. Is each of them wants a certain amount of elbow room, and trying to Tetris everything together has been an exciting challenge.
Andy Dureau says she grew up in 4-H, where she mostly did indoor projects. She says this kind of space creates more opportunities for young people to explore their interests.
I did sewing 4-H growing up. I think I probably would have branched out more into the archery and woodworking if I had had that option. It's so cool that they're going to include both of those. And then there's cooking in there as well. So they also are doing robotics. So that would be a super neat project to get into. And the other great thing about this space is it's so multi-purpose. I'm not exactly sure what all they're going to do in it. So I think that there's an excitement of, well, what do I want to learn, and knowing that this space can probably accommodate it.
The building will also utilize a high-efficiency mechanical system and could have a solar array built in. Designers say the goal is to get the project as close to net zero energy as possible. CSU's County Extension Director Carla Ferrand says that establishing a space for science, technology, engineering, and mathematics in Garfield County is a dream come true. You can find more information about the Education Center, including pictures, on our website, kdnk.org. I'm Lucas Turner.
KDNK has an ongoing series about opioid addiction and treatment, and as part of that series, Jared Rollins, director of the Community Opioid Treatment Strategy Coalition, sat down with Debbie Wild, a community organizer working on a detox center in Glenwood Springs. Here's part one of that conversation.
We don't have a detox in the Garfield County portion of the valley and haven't for a good dozen years. There's some detox now up in Pitkin County that's happened in the last couple years, so that's really awesome. But the need is definitely there. And really how this all began was the city of Glenwood Springs approached me to help look at the issue of homelessness, which we know has been a growing issue around the country and certainly just more and more visible in our valley. And it didn't take but a first interview. Not that I was surprised, not that I didn't know, but I began with the emergency services, and the first thing that I heard from both the fire and the police were, you know, we have really substance abuse and mental health problem and issues. And yeah, it is definitely connected and correlated with homelessness, and it's all kind of lumped together. Not every person who's homeless has mental health or substance abuse issues, right? And not everybody who has substance abuse issues or mental health is homeless. But there is a large piece where all of that overlaps. And certainly in a more chronic and more pronounced way, because not having a home and being displaced in that manner, it just exacerbates all of those other issues. So that's where, as soon as you turn around with that, it was like, well, we don't even have the first place to start as far as a detox. And particularly then, because my next interview was at the hospital emergency room, that's where police and or fire, bring people, unless there's a crime committed and they end up at the jail. So we're using all of our emergency, very expensive services in a way that they were not really built for. And I began to see right away that we were using, you know, emergency response for chronic issues. And those tools just don't work. And then so what happens is we just keep doing the same thing over and over again. So that's kind of where the beginning was.
All right. Where are you guys at in the process of creating this more useful way of using our services?
Right, right. Or a more appropriate for what the issue is, mm-hmm. right? It's sort of like you have to have the right tools for the right issue if you're going to really address it. What I've said to people and been a part of is that we really, when you think about all these parts, it's systems change, right? So we began to get together those who were stakeholders in some way, and create what we're calling a recovery continuum task force. Now, that's really critical, number one, because that is that, you know, it brings together this collaboration of people. Number two, we're looking at the whole recovery continuum, that it's not just about detox as in a facility, a one place where you drop somebody off when they're under the influence of alcohol or other drugs, right? And then you leave and go back to your work, because that's not really the way that we end up solving the problem, right? What we need is for people to live in recovery. That's when we get to the end point, and that's when you don't see the chronic things over and over again, and that's when we're truly helping each other. So we're calling it recovery continuum and looking at that all along the way, and certainly detox and or a detox facility, you know, a dedicated place is one step in that continuum. Now, that task force has grown. It keeps growing. We have people from all over the county involved. And we have just been going at this for 3 months. And this was something that people said, no, we tried it before. We've been trying it for years. We can't do it. And it's very exciting to see the enthusiasm and how far we've come.
Do you have any way for people to get information on this effort or a next step that they can be involved in?
Well, I've been trying to kind of keep people who are really interested kind of in the loop, if you would, and create some communication. I think we'll start doing that in a more public way, right? But people can email me at Deborah L. Wilde, D-E-B-R-A-L, middle initial Wilde, W-I-L-D-E, and then just the zip code 81601, right? So that's easy to remember. That's the Glenwood zip code. So Deborah L. Wilde, 81601, @gmail.com. And then that is one way that I can just keep people informed. I've got one piece that put together, you know, kind of a white paper of sort of the exploration of these issues at the community level for the last several months. So what I've found is that just right initially being informed and understanding there's a whole lot more to know, that would be a beginning step right now.
You can find part two of Jared Rollins' conversation with community organizer Debbie Wilde and other stories from the series on opioid addiction and treatment at kdnk.org. KDNK reporter Nick Eisenberg examined the California Zephyr, one of Amtrak's longest rail routes, for this week's edition of The Tactile Traveler.
It goes from Chicago to Emeryville, California, which is a suburb of San Francisco. During its 3-day and night trip, it stops at Lincoln and Omaha, Nebraska, Denver, Colorado, Salt Lake City, Utah, and Sacramento, California, and many small and smaller cities along the way. One of those cities is Glenwood Springs, Colorado, where I live. The most popular segment of the trip is from Denver to Glenwood Springs, where it goes through the spectacular Glenwood Canyon, along the Upper Colorado River, and through beautiful mountain passes where it's difficult to get to by car. Assistant conductor Nick Ploiza says one of the things our sighted friends will remember is the scenery they didn't expect to see.
You know, I don't know where that tradition started. Yeah, on the Colorado River, they like to moon us. And I don't know, like I said, I don't know when it started, but if it's a nice day out and the train goes by, they like to moon us. So everybody kind of laughs, and they named it the Moon River, nicknamed it the Moon River. So
how many times on a trip from Denver, Glenwood Springs to Denver?
Oh, dozens, depending on the day.
Passenger Linda Hayes.
Yes, we certainly did get mooned.
How do you feel about that?
Oh, I guess it's kind of funny. It's certainly not something I would do, but, you know, young kids are young kids.
Even though we never see folks we'd never recognize if we met later, we will see Amtrak employees that are really there for us when we can use some assistance. From helping us check our luggage to making sure we get on the right car on the right train. And at the other end, having someone meet us at our train car door and walk or drive us to where we need to go in the train station. Assistant conductor Nick Ploiza says they'll even help you walk your guide dog at scheduled stops.
So like Frasier, we would, you know, if the service animal would need off the train, the person with the dog could walk them or whatever they needed to do for that animal. So either the coach attendant or the sleeper attendant if they're in the sleeper or the conductor. We'll make sure they get back on the train.
They'll even hold the train until your dog is done. That's one of the things that makes Amtrak very different from buses and trains. And Amtrak may be much cheaper than traveling by Greyhound and much more pleasant. There's also a big problem riding the Zephyr. It's frequently late, very late. Frequently an hour or two, and occasionally more than 8 hours. So you should plan the rest of your schedule accordingly. For example, when I use the Zephyr to go to Denver and Philadelphia for eye surgery, I always plan my schedule to arrive 2 days before important appointments. That way, even if the train was very late, I would get to my destination the day before my important appointments. So it's important to call Amtrak and check on your train status starting the day before your trip. So if I know my train's going to be late going to Denver, I will still have time to cancel my ticket and go by bus. However, in the winter, Amtrak is still usually more dependable than driving or taking a bus to Denver during bad weather. That's because I-70 frequently closes for hours at a time. Going through the Colorado Mountains because of accidents and jackknife 18-wheelers when drivers fail to put on chains. I've been stuck in closed airports and delayed or even stopped trains. And I'd much rather be on a train. You have a comfortable seat, food available, and Amtrak employees helping you figure out how you can reach your destination on time. You need reservations for tickets on the Zephyr. When you buy those tickets will determine how much they cost, so make reservations early to get the best price. But even if you don't have one of the cheapest seats, keep trying. Because if someone cancels a lower price seat, you can exchange your ticket for the lower price seat. Nick Eisenberg, KDNK News.
The Tactile Traveler is a podcast and radio show to encourage and support blind and low vision people to explore the world. You can hear past episodes at kdnk.org or search The Tactile Traveler wherever you listen to podcasts. And finally, Colorado nighttime drone sightings are spreading west. A fleet of drones has been spotted flying between 7 and 10 p.m. over Glenwood Springs during the past week, reports the Post-Independent, but no one is owning up to owning them. Similar activity was reported in December in northeast Colorado and Nebraska, but it's unclear if the Glenwood drone sightings are related. Glenwood Springs Police Chief Joseph Dara said they appear to be larger commercial drones. He added that people who have spotted blinking lights from the unmanned aircraft say they don't appear to be doing anything suspicious. Residents of Fort Collins, Colorado, reported similar sightings in January. That does it for this week's newsreel on KDNK. All of our stories and more are at kdnk.org. The Weekly Newsreel is a news magazine that takes a look at the week's top local and regional news stories aired on KDNK between Monday and Friday. Subscribe to our podcast and give us a review on iTunes. If you have a tip on something you'd like the KDNK news team to cover, send it to news@kdnk.org. All submissions are confidential. I'm Amy Haddon Marsh. Thanks for listening and have a great week.